Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to the panel today and putting in your schedule and showing up. It's awesome to see everybody. You're here with the Radio Free Yoga, Self-Realized by Social Enterprise Dream Team. And we're really, really honored to have you. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Jess to say welcome, and then we're going to start a video for you guys to watch.
And we're going to introduce.
Actually, we're going to have Mr. Waylon Lewis initiate the get the panel started. We're going to get it rock and roll. We're going to wake up and get it going here Waylon style.
So this is just the traditional Buddhist way of opening a meeting. It takes about half an hour. You just close your eyes. It'll be a series of chants. You don't need to know the meaning. No, actually what it is, it's just a simple bow. So you just take a good posture. And it's just our funny little Buddhist way of reminding ourselves of mutual respect for you out there and us up here and what we're all trying to do, which hopefully is to use this social media stuff to be of benefit. So take a good posture. And bow. And that's it.
So we're going to kick it off with a little video that was created by an amazing company called Feel Good Now. And what we did when we found out we were coming to South by Southwest is we put a call out to the community asking, what does social media mean to you? And how are you using mindfulness, yogic principles? How are you authentically engaging through these platforms via social media? So we're going to start with a video. Enjoy it.
Yoga brought to the world a celebration of mindfulness and compassion towards others and opening ourselves to more than just the corporeal experience of human life. Now we're doing that on a digital level. Now we celebrate the present moment more than we ever have in the past. What could be more yogic in principle than Twitter or Instagram or your Facebook feed?
What are we saying about ourselves? What are we thinking about? What are we sharing? What are we posting? What words are we using? It's almost like it's an Akashic record. Once you put it up into social media, it never goes away. There's this life force that our collective consciousness creates. And through our individual profiles and accounts, we kind of tap into it. We are in that moment, Facebook or Twitter.
I would say that the yoga community is setting a huge example in the ways that we communicate online by taking the tools we utilize in life, like the yamas and the niyamas and the eight limbs of yoga, and applying them online, we're setting standards for healthier communication all over.
We no longer need to search far and wide to find a teacher. We can go to Tumblr, we can go to Twitter, we can go to Facebook, we can go to Where's My Guru, and we can learn Dharma.
You might feel very isolated, very stuck wherever you are. And social media provides you a sangha, a holy community of people that you build through your networks that raises you up. We can change this world by using social media.
See the difference that it will make when you act mindfully in your digital life and how it'll change your relationships in your physical life.
I really feel like we're at the beginning of something huge here. I can't wait to see, even in just a year from now, the ways that we impact social media, how it's changed the ways that everybody communicates online.
This is where we get off the mat, onto the keyboard, and onto the streets. This is our digital revolution, and this is where the world will change.
Thanks so much for watching that. And I'd like to introduce myself, and I'm going to go down the line, and then everyone's going to introduce themselves. So I'm Diane Ferraro, and I'm with Where Is My Guru? We're an online radio show.
I'm Waylon Lewis with ElephantJournal.com and Walk the Talk Show with myself.
I'm Sean Korn. I'm a yoga teacher, and I'm the co-founder of Off the Mat Into the World.
I'm Jessica Durvaj, and I am the founder and co-host of Where's My Guru?
I'm Vikram Gandhi. I'm the director of a film called Kumare, and I'm a fake guru.
And that's the dream team. Om Shanti. And the dream team has spoken. We're calling ourselves the dream team because this really is a dream to be up here and be able to communicate with all of you. And it's really amazing to see you all here and interested in mindful media. And we're so interested in it, too. So it's very inspiring to us. So we'd like to talk a little bit about what Radio Free means to us and what the whole title of the panel is about. So let's look at each word, radio free yoga, self-realized by social enterprise. So radio meaning signal. I'm a signal, you're a signal, we're all a signal. Free, there you go. Yoga, unity, bringing it all together. Self-realized sounds lofty, but believe it or not, we're just talking about knowing thyself, just knowing who you are, knowing what it is that you want and how you want to say it. And that X is that cool little by that South by Southwest has adopted. And social enterprise, it's any organization, whether it's a 501c3 or a for-profit organization, but their intentions are philanthropic in nature. They're there to help be the change we all wish to see. So there you have it, Radio Free Yoga, self-realized by social enterprise. And to us, Radio Free is also a play on words of what Radio Free Europe or Radio Free Tibet is about. And I'm going to turn that over to Wayland to talk a little bit about some grassroots Radio Free journalism and his take on what Radio Free means.
Well, just reading over my talking points. Well, Radio Free is a kind of complex term for those of you who know the history of media. Radio, like Radio Free Tibet, for example, is one of the only sources of somewhat objective media in Tibet. So traditionally, it was a sort of government-sponsored media that we would, but it was kind of propaganda-ish as well, that would go into countries that we didn't like or that didn't have their own free media. Generally, it was pretty altruistic, very kind of NPR-ish, and pretty good stuff. So I think we're somewhat redefining that as offering, you know, taking advantage of what has happened in media in the last 15 years, where traditionally media, even if it was wonderful media like the New York Times, which I love and respect, it was a top-down sort of communication from journalists and editors to we the people. And then, you know, blogging happened, the internet happened, and now, you know, there's mommy bloggers, anyone can have a blog, and often the news is created, as we've just seen, if you've seen the Kony 2012 video, the news is created by people, as we saw in that video, by people being inspired to click the share button or the like button or to retweet or to pin something on Pinterest, whatever the flavor of the month is. So there's a lot of good and bad in the grassroots nature of media now. A lot of the quality, a lot of the objectivity has gone away, and people now are paying attention to their little silo that they already agree with, whether it's MSNBC or Fox or whatever it is. So we with Elephant are, part of our mission is to embrace those crazy comments. You always see these crazy comments online. And we're really trying to have dialogue and to try and kind of retrain our muscle that has become so weakened over the last 10 or 20 years in civic life of being able to disagree with people civilly, to be able to have different opinions and to learn and open your mind, which obviously brings it back to yoga or Buddhism or a spiritual path, whatever our religion is, by remaining open and to new ideas. So it's an exciting time. The grassroots really, the tail is wagging the dog, and that's certainly not all positive, but I think we up here are trying to engage, to use these incredible tools we have and engage them for the benefit of all sentient beings. So I don't know if that's what I was supposed to talk about, but that is what I just said.
Sounds amazing.
Okay, so this is the history of yoga in 5 minutes. I think a general desire that people have in yoga is to find what's authentic. And so, of course, we always look back into history. And if you look at this chart, I would say just right above the screen would be kind of a bigger blob or amorphous area that would be where yoga came from, which is, I would say, the indigenous religion of India. And it's hard to say exactly when the first person started doing yoga. We're not sure when somebody started stretching for the first time or decided to close their eyes and start meditating. But what we do know is that the first time it's compiled is by someone named Patanjali. Sometimes he's a historical figure, and sometimes he's a multi-headed serpent type figure. So, but in the Yoga Sutra, there's references to asanas as we see in modern day yoga, and then behavioral and ethical codes, which we're speaking about today, yamas and niyamas, which we'll talk about later, and also meditation and philosophy. And then I think if you go down, you can see how it's changed and become much, much more specific. And most of the yoga we know today in America, this isn't a full blanket statement, but much of what we know comes from sort of a reformation of yoga in the last 150 years. And a lot of it comes from Krishnamacharya. So we see a younger yoga and vinyasa, Ashtanga yoga coming from around the 1930s. And even that is, it's mostly physical. So it's asanas that we see mostly. But a lot of that also comes from this man, Krishnamacharya, who was working in Mysore in the court of the king, and he kind of put together all these exercises. And some of that even includes using British military exercises. So what we see today, we're not exactly sure if it resembles what came in the past from yoga, but we see lots of different kinds. And at the bottom, you can see it splitting up, and you can't really read it, but Sean Korn is at the bottom there. So
we're going to let Sean talk about her part on the chart here, too, now.
What I think is kind of interesting is that you can see how it's there's an explosion that's really been happening with yoga, and especially happened in the 90s. And what I find fascinating is it really does run parallel with the explosion of technology. Everything's really coming at us in a very accelerated rate, and we saw it in yoga, that suddenly people were really, they were free thinkers, and they didn't want to necessarily get tied down to an individual form of yoga. And suddenly there were so many different styles of yoga that people can explore, and they'd stay with one style for a while, and then it would morph into another style, so that each individual person had the opportunity to define what yoga was for them, which is very different in the way that it was. We were told how our yoga was, what our spirituality was, and we adhered to the belief system of a guru. And it's changed a lot. And with that, just like technology, there's the good and there's the bad. In the positive, in the transformation of yoga and how broad it is, I mean, you get yoga in the gym, you get it in schools, if we're lucky, and you get it, of course, in yoga schools. And there's a variety of different styles that we can land in. When there's not a tradition that supports it, the teacher can really run amok, and they can bring anything they want into it, regardless of their own sophistication or healing or understanding of the practice of yoga. And then that information is then being passed on to the student. What's good about that is it's creative, and yoga should be creative. Yoga means to come together and make whole. It recognizes unity. So when we're looking towards unity, we have to experience all of its variety to be able to hone it into its singular form. And so on that level, I love the expression of this. Where it gets a little bit funky is that anyone can have an opinion about yoga and bring it into their classes, and suddenly it becomes tried and true. And if the person is not healed or healing, they're bringing that information in as well. So the purposefulness of the practice can get diluted. There could be misinformation and injury, both physically and emotionally. And it's the same with the internet. It's happening so fast that there's not a lot of regulation behind it. What's good is that it's connecting all these people all over the world creating that yoga. What's negative is that without certain regulation, ethical regulation, people get crazy. They can get hurtful in the comments. They can put out anything that can really impact lives, that can tell stories that might not necessarily be accurate. So what's exciting is that both in technology and in yoga, we have no idea where it's going. And I think that that ultimately is a good thing, but we have an individual responsibility to make sure that our inclusion, both in the yoga and in technology, is in integrity. We can't really focus on the rest of the world. We got to start here. And the yoga practice allows us the methodology so that we can go into technology in a way that's more open-hearted, fair-minded, and inclusive.
Perfect.
Oh, thank you.
Amazing. And talking about technology, built into yoga are the yamas. The yamas are how we interact with the world. The niyamas are how we come inside ourselves and look within. So we're going to go back to Vikram, and he's going to give us an overview of the yamas.
Okay. Sure. Well, I think in the Yoga Sutra, you have these code of ethics, and it's not that different from the way it's presented. People have ethics presented in their own lives in different ways. So, you know, there are 10 commandments, there are different codes, and the yamas here are, you know, I'll just go through them, and there are two pages. Ahimsa, nonviolence; satya, truth; and then the next page is asteya, not stealing; brahmacharya, celibacy; and aparigraha, which means don't be a greedy bugger. So they're really basic, and I think that the first thing to realize is that most of us should not have to be told about these things. You know, just like, you know, thou shalt not kill. You don't we hope that we live in a world where you don't have to be told that. But I think, you know, when these rules were presented to me, having grown up in a Hindu home, it wasn't in the form of a yoga sutra. It was in the form of Hinduism. And in a lot of ways, yoga is the core, the spiritual core of Hinduism. And like anybody who has grown up in a religion, you know, kind of have to rebel against things. And so when I look at these yamas, I think of these as sort of guidelines and reminders. Another thing that it's interesting is that we've, just like in general how things have evolved, a lot of these definitions have evolved also. So I've talked to a scholar of yoga philosophy, and he told me, well, you know, America has major problems because aparigraha means no greed, and that means that a yoga teacher should never take money, ever. And so I thought that was really interesting. But maybe in the context of a tradition where yogis are given alms and there's a whole tradition around it, possibly that would make a lot of sense. But it might be hard to justify that in America. Same thing with brahmacharya, which means celibacy, is often taken and said, well, hey, that seems a little harsh. Which is what I thought. I took a vow of celibacy at 13 in a ritual that I wasn't fully aware of. That my adherence to the yamas changed at a certain point. So I think, you know, all of these things are guidelines, and you have to interpret them as you would anything in your life. And it's just, I think sometimes because it's so foreign and it's called the yamas, that there must be something very magical about them. And maybe it's easy to be judgmental, but I think all these things have to be fit into what makes sense in our own lives, and not necessarily saying that we should rewrite history and say that brahmacharya means something else, but just that, you know, we have to figure out how all these things in yoga fit into our lives and not kind of front that we're doing something we're not. I don't know if anyone wants to add to that.
Waylon's going to talk a little bit about his experience with his ethics of what he follows, which is Buddhism. So we are following the vowel regulation. We're having variety on our panel. So here comes the Buddhist.
Dun, dun, dun. Feels like a competition. Well, we have 9 or 10 yamas. And they're huge. Yeah, Buddhism, I guess you could talk about it in terms of ethics, but I actually just brought Elephant's new tote bag, not because it's swag, but because it actually sort of sums up what we think about as Buddhists. It's pretty simple. Eleanor Roosevelt really could have said the same thing. It's like one of those quotes. If you want to be happy, think first of others. On the other side, if you want to be unhappy, think only about yourself. So it's less in the context of ethics and more in the context of how to simply just be a good person, true to yourself, veritas, know thyself, and be of benefit to others. Because when it comes down to it, it's much more fun to live for and think about others than it is to wake up and obsess about yourself, which is fine, except that it doesn't really help. The sort of greed thing that's in the yamas is not great to want too much for yourself, because on some level it just doesn't work. You don't make yourself happier by having tons of stuff. You make yourself happier by being able to like yourself, whether you're alone or in a crowd, or you have lots of stuff, or you're poor, or you're in a good mood or a bad mood. So from the Buddhist point of view, we wake up each morning, we meditate, and that's not really a spiritual practice. That's simply just training our mind, which is a very busy, discursive mind that loves to think, you know, it's the mantra or the recitation of the mind is, what about me, what about me, what about me, what about me, what about me? So you're simply retraining that mantra to say, oh, here's the present moment. Wow. And the present moment is where we can enjoy life and where we can fall in love with others and where we can be of benefit and where we can have fun. Anything that you've ever done that you cherish happened in the present moment. So from that, it follows that business, I guess, quickly is not really an obstacle. It's not considered an evil. It's considered hopefully an expression of your path to be of benefit. So if your business is not an expression of that path, we all need to rejigger that business, or possibly, you know, get a new job or start a new company. And then compassion is good. Walk your talk. So yeah, when you find that your desires or actions are in conflict with who you want to be and how you want to be of benefit, obviously you need to synchronize your actions and your aspirations.
I just want to jump in a little bit for anybody that's not familiar with Elephant. The first point on there, it says from print to pioneer. Oh. You know, when you are, I'm going to give you some shout outs.
Thank
kudos.
You.
When you are following a code of ethics, sometimes you need to make decisions that may not have what maybe you call like an immediate benefit. So when Elephant was a print magazine, would you model your print magazine? Thank you.
Sean and Diane could model it better than I did.
They had a lot of advertisers. They were doing really well, and the code of ethics that Waylon was following was like, this doesn't seem good for the planet anymore. So we moved online 4 years ago. And basically all the revenue went away.
We gave up our office. We gave up our staff. So it is hard to walk your talk. It's not just nice words on a display here at South by Southwest. You have to make decisions sometimes that aren't fun. Usually, walking your talk is actually more fun, I would say.
So just, you know, wanted to, you know, when we are doing that in our business or in our personal life, we have to make some hard choices sometimes. But in the end, it's going to be greater benefit to us and greater benefit to all.
And, and when we talked about the title of this presentation, Self-Realize, here we get to that scary, lofty place, right? Self-realization. Oh, no. Remember what we said at the beginning, know thyself, right? So Waylon started his business and said, I don't dig on this kill and tree thing. I'm going to switch. And he's the hardest working guy I know, except for Jess, the hardest working girl, both in the media.
And Sean are both
more hard work. Totally. Yeah, they're just on another plane of work. But we're going to talk a little bit now. We're going to look to Sean and Vikram again. We're going to talk about how does one develop self-realization? And why is self-realization important when communicating with others? And as we ask these questions, we believe that you're knowing some of these answers as well. So either Vikram or Sean, whoever wants to talk a little bit about that.
this is always going to be a more challenging aspect of the conversation because it means taking complete responsibility for the whole of your life and your own experience. And it's much easier to point the finger outward and tell the world how it should live its life and how it should behave, including the internet, and forget to point that finger back at ourselves and hold ourselves accountable for the choices that we're making. In the practice of yoga, we're taught that there is no separation, that everything is connected, whether it's the mind or the body or male or female, even consciousness and technology, everything is connected and everything is interdependent upon this whole. And that ultimately why we're here and what we're doing on this planet, as far as we can even possibly know in relationship to our five senses, is that we're here to love, and we're here to love big. But in the process of learning how to love, part of the human experience, challenge, and dilemma is we also have to explore its opposite, what love is not. That's just life. And therefore, people we love die. Things happen that are incomprehensible to the soul. What yoga teaches us is not to bypass the challenges of life, but how to go towards them and gain a new perspective as a result, to shift our experience of it so we can gain value. So everyone knows love. Everyone also knows rage and fear and guilt and grief. But when we're not supported in the process of understanding those bigger emotions, we repress them. We suppress them. That suppression becomes tension, stress, anxiety. That stress becomes disease, it becomes depression, and it creates separation. And so through the practice of yoga, as one of the modalities, we can release the tension so that we can expose the vulnerability. And exposing the vulnerability, we begin to remember who we are and therefore who we are to each other. And we can start to take responsibility for our life and see and really start to understand why things have happened as they have. And rather than live our life as a victim, we see the potential and the possibility in all of our experiences, whether they're positive or they're negative. But this is an individualized truth. So self-realization comes first when, instead of looking at the world, turning it back in and saying, where am I living in separation? Where am I creating a me and a you, an us and a them? And how has that separation served me? And how has it prevented me from truly stepping into my own power, my purpose, and my love? And so yoga is a methodology, chanting, prayer, the program, therapy, life coaches. There is a myriad of different kinds of traditions that speaks to each one of us at different times in our realization so that we can learn a piece of information that'll ultimately open ourselves up to a bigger vision, a bigger ideology, and to love. And so when we're looking at the internet, for example, very often people don't have this process. They read information, they get triggered, their anger becomes instantaneous, and what happens is they react quickly and anonymously. And therefore, you can say anything and take no responsibility for it. Rather than taking that moment, taking a breath, and looking at the internet as a mirror, what did this teach me about myself? Is there another way to engage this conversation that doesn't perpetuate separation? Am I a part of the problem, or am I activating the solution through love, through compassion, through mindfulness? This, to me, is the opportunity, but it requires deep, hard work that the individual must initiate. Otherwise, you can see that we'll continue to fracture the community in the same way that we're fracturing the self.
This slide has been sitting up here.
You got about a minute.
So just to explain. So last year I was here with a film called Kumari, and Kumari is a character that is a fake guru that I play. And I in order to make this film, what I did was I did what any popular yoga teacher might do if they weren't real. They just make a website. So I made a website called kumari.org of a guru from a foreign place that you've never heard of, with a philosophy that existed only briefly before writing that website up, called the Mirror Philosophy. And I just created a website and put that out there on the internet. And then I made a video where people chanted to this guru that no one had ever met, using some pictures of myself in India. That's one of them, me hanging out with another guru. And then, you know, this was put out on the internet. And then I made a film called Kumari about me going to Arizona to inspire people as a guru, as a fake guru. So the purpose of the film is, you know, it seems as if it's just some kind of prank. However, the whole purpose is how does self-realization work, and how do people how can people use gurus, and what is an authentic teacher? And I think, you know, not to get too much into the film, but the whole point of view was and is that, you know, what everyone is looking for is inside themselves, and that their teachers that are great, that are out there in the world to inspire, but it's really what happens inside us that is self-realization. And also, you know, I think one of the interesting things is the idea of self-realization is sometimes put on a pedestal, like, you know, which is why there is, you know, this guru culture that I was critiquing, is that, oh, of course, this person has achieved something that I haven't achieved. They've self-realized, and I can get some of that, you know. And I was trying to play around with these ideas of what people were looking for in others. And the reality was that, you know, I was really not teaching anything. It was just kind of a mirror for people, and that people were inspiring themselves. And so I think why it's relevant with technology is that there are so many people out there in the world that can inspire us, and we can get little pieces of information on the internet, and often out of context, and a lot of times it can be like white noise. And I think it's important that as we're more connected and we're connecting to all these different people, that we have to continue to realize that that it's really, you know, going outward and finding someone else to inspire us is great, but it really has to do with what's inside us. And no amount of being connected to no amount of yoga teachers or gurus on Facebook is ever going to really help that unless we're, you know, doing it ourselves. So I think, and I think technology is great for connecting for information and finding these people, you know, because you don't have to travel as far, but, you know, it doesn't take off any of the weight that we have on ourselves to do that on our own. So that's what that slide is about.
Beautiful. And so what are our moral obligations then as communicators and ambassadors of the social media community? Well, Where's My Guru was founded by Jess Duravage. Jess, you want to speak a little bit about this?
Sure. So what does all this have to do with, like, what with South by Southwest and social media and all the, you know, talking about self-realization and yoga and the yamas? Why is that important? Well, I don't know if anybody's seen, you know, checked out their timeline lately, but I remember the day that I saw on Facebook, it said, this is what you were doing in 2008, and this is what you were doing in 2009, and what if I was, like, just completely miserable? You know, your patterns and your habits are showing up to you right in your face. So, like, Sean and Vikram have both said, it's a mirror. You know, it's now becoming a mirror for who we are as individuals. And so it's a great teacher in some way for us to be able to sit back and reflect. And, you know, and Sean teaches a lot about the shadow. And so it's not something to run away from. It's something to turn to and embrace. And so I feel that, you know, we are up here choosing a lens of yoga, you know, to express ourselves. That's the lens that we choose. Everybody can choose whatever kind of lens that they want. But the choice that I've made is I've chosen to use these yamas and these niyamas. You can choose the golden rule. You can choose the Ten Commandments. But, you know, what we are really trying to share is what the ambassador that I want to be is to make conscious choices to choose those lenses as I express myself in the world. You don't turn this off when you turn the computer on. You know, you don't turn off your moral obligation. I have a great yoga teacher that says, if you go take a yoga class and you're feeling all inspired and wonderful, you get out in your car, somebody cuts you off and you flip them off. Well, then how inspired are you really? You get online, you see something that really pisses you off, and then you, like, make this hateful comment, and then you just walk away, and you think that that doesn't have an impact? You think that that's not rippling out? So what do you want to ripple out? You know, right now, right here, there's all of these streaming messages happening that are rippling out and touching all these sorts of people. What do you want to send? What do you want to share? How do you want to show up? So,
yeah. Wei?
I guess more from a general point of view of, like, in Boulder, I live on the College Hill, and I see college kids, particularly, you know, the sort of Facebook, iPhone generation, no longer have the ability to walk from their house to the campus. They all do what half of you are doing right now, which is staring at your iPhone as they do it walking into trees. And what's truly sad about that, from not even from a yoga point of view or a Buddhist point of view, just from a human point of view, is that the place where ideas come from, the place where inspiration comes from, the place that figures out how to settle the mind down and how to be a a happy person, the place that sees the leaves on the tree and enjoys the day, is going away because of a lot of what South by Southwest and what this panel loves so much, which is social media and communication. So I would say one of our first obligations as communicators and ambassadors of the social media community is to shut up and is to really only share things that are helpful or mindful. And there's such a noise factor, where I want followers and I want fans, and you're going to panels finding out how to get more followers and fans. And like Vikram said, like on some level, you know, all of that is great. Connecting is great. Interdependence is great. Interaction is great. But it's only as great as the content. And if the content is hype or noise or trying to sell something ego, it actually can be what my tradition would call spiritual materialism, where you're using all the tools you're given in the world, whether it's meditation or yoga or Twitter, to build yourself up instead of to open yourself up to reality. So again, the reality or the present moment is the only place where we can actually live life. So these are, in a sense, weapons, you know, Twitter, Pinterest, all this stuff, and they need to be respected and used very precisely. Maybe not weapons, but tools. So they need to be used properly. And as an editor with a website, and I'm obsessed with Twitter followers and fans and all this stuff, it's my job to make sure that what we're putting out is of benefit to others. And whenever we put out a blog that's someone talking about how, you know, their worship of unicorns and crystals and rainbows has made them a happier person, that makes me feel sick. Because that is, you know, while I respect unicorns, rainbows, and crystals, that is probably not a message that is, anyway, it's a longer story. But we need to be talking about genuine practice. As Sean said, facing the shadow, it's not all happy rainbows. So.
Yeah. I had a friend in college who thought unicorns were real because she saw white animals in, like,
they're
cold.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. They are. They are real. And they're very real. They're real. Look on the endangered list, but they're there. So we practice yoga, some of us. Some of us practice Buddhism. Some of us practice atheism. But if you're practicing atheism and you're doing right on stuff, right on. Who cares, really, is what we're trying to say. But let's pay attention. I loved what Waylon just said about opening up, right? About opening up yourself.
Sorry, I was tweeting. I didn't hear what you
awesome.
Were saying.
Awesome. See? It's awesome. That's why we have him here. He's an amazing guy. So here we go for social enterprise. We promised you we would get to this question by the end of our panel. So social enterprise, we talked about how we show up in the world. You know, how do we help advance positive change? And Sean Corin is a co-founder, and Kelly Carey is over here. She's her colleague. And Off the Mat Into the World is an incredible organization that is based on philanthropic intentions. So we're going to turn this right over to Sean. How can we advance philanthropy through social media?
My first experience of that was, I imagine it's about 8 years ago now. I was the national yoga ambassador for an organization called Youth AIDS, and they had invited me to come to Mumbai to work in the red light district and in brothels. With prostitutes and learn a little bit more about the HIV/AIDS pandemic in that culture. And while I was there, it was one of the first times in many, many years where I was really in conflict with my own spirituality, the belief system that I come from, that everything happens the way it's supposed to for your soul to transform, yada, yada. When you're dealing with an 8-year-old child who's severely sexually abused and addicted to meth and seeing 40 clients a day, it was really hard for me to hold that perspective of where's God here when I believe that God is everywhere. Well, where's God there? And I had a real spiritual crisis while I was in this environment, and I chose at that time to blog. It was the first time I've ever blogged. And I was pretty forthright. I think I was very naive at that time. I didn't realize how many people actually read this stuff. And I came late to the party. And so I just started to share the conflict I was having spiritually and the resolution. And every single day I would have this conflict, and within 24 hours, somehow the answer to whatever this conflict was would be answered in the most funkiest, weirdest, mystical way. Either a prostitute would say or do something, or a pimp would say or do something, and suddenly it would go right to my gut and I would get the answer, but really through the shadow, and I would share that. And I couldn't have made the stories more uncomfortable, because they were uncomfortable and gruesome. And what happened was I received hundreds, maybe even thousands, of letters and comments from people saying, how can I do this? How can I come on these trips? How can I have this experience? And I thought, really? Because I'm on my knees. And I realized that by sharing these stories and by creating an opportunity for a really broad audience to experience both my conflict and my resolution, and sometimes it never did get resolved, but to have that level of intimacy created a relationship and a connection that I could not have done otherwise. And in some ways, I was a little bit braver online than I was even in this kind of communication. And it sparked what ultimately became one of the biggest projects at Off the Mat Into the World, which was these humanitarian tours. We've now raised well over $2 million for different... Thank you. And... by reaching out to the yoga community and engaging them to take leadership positions within their own community and raise money, raise significant funds to be able to come overseas and do this. Part of it, though, if you can raise the money and come do this, is you got to blog about it. Every single day, we ask someone to blog and tell their story. We do not censor it. We do not tell them what to write. We just want them to share their experience with the world. That was one way. Another way that was really effective is after years of being an off the mat and starting to develop a community, and again, using Facebook, using Twitter, using all these other methodologies to reach the broader national community. There's 20 million yogis. Occupy Wall Street happened. And it was 3 weeks in, and as a team, we decided that we wanted to do some sort of a mobilization. And we did it in, 36 hours, I would say. We put it out on Facebook. We did a couple of invites. We asked Elephant Journal to let people know what we were doing. And within a very short amount of time, we were able to get 500, 600 yogis to come down to the park in Occupy and support this effort of awareness and unity building. And it really kept sparking, like, this is happening. This is the way that it works. And our newest effort is we're going one step further. We've created something called Yoga Votes, which is mobilizing the community around the 2012 election. And we intend to use Twitter and social media in all of its forms to encourage people within the yoga community to get out and vote, to raise awareness within their own community, to find out about the issues. And if the issues aren't alignment with the values and the ethics of yoga, and also to encourage people, diverse, whether they're Tea Partiers, Republicans, Democrats, progressives, to talk about the interconnection, the intersection between yoga and politics, and create a conversation. And the only way we can really support that level of diversity is through the internet. And so we're really excited about the possibility. And as a result, we only see how far this can go, not only in raising money, but raising awareness, which is just as important in the cultivation of change.
Right on. Wow. So it's 11:46. We want to open this up to questions, but we want to say one more thing.
I think Waylon was going to chat about...
Oh, Waylon wants to talk about Coney. Right. Sorry. Sorry, forgot about that.
Well, it's not much to say, but how many people here have seen the Coney 2012 video? So, looks like 20%. So, this video just came out a couple days ago. We've been blogging about it, like everybody else, a fair amount. It's controversial in some ways, but the basic point I wanted to touch on is that this video begins talking about a warlord in Africa. It's a complex situation. No one really knows, and historically no one has really cared about what's going on, and that's been a problem. And this video, what's the average length of a video that's successful on YouTube? It's probably 2 to 4 minutes, right? This video is half an hour, and in, I don't know how many days it's been now, but 4 or 5 days, it's up to 55 million views. It's on the cover of the New York Times. It's on the cover of everything. And it's about a complex issue that, again, that nobody has really cared about. So what this video does, very similarly to Where Is My Guru's video, is it talks about the grassroots ability to harness that share button or that like button, that social media, to create meaningful change in the actual world, not just in, you know, some sort of social media world where you get more fans and followers. They're actually raising money, like Sean has done, to change suffering, hopefully for the better. Again, it's a complex issue, but it's, if you haven't seen it, it's worth checking out if you're interested in this conversation. Kona is probably easily the most successful video of all time at this point to do that.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so we have one final question, and we're going to go across the panel and say why we believe in this, or what are the reasons why we feel, is it possible to generate abundance and save the world simultaneously? So we'll start with you, Vikram. But we've only got like 10 words or less. It's an elevator pitch. Yeah.
Probably.
Right. Yeah.
No, that's all I have to say. Okay. Probably, yes.
Love it.
Absolutely.
Good, I'm going to take their 30 words. I can only speak from my own experience, but since I've been involved in social action in the way that I have, I've never been happier. I've never felt more committed and more connected in all of my relationships, and my financial situation just keeps expanding. I don't know if there's a direct correlation to it, but all I do know is that when abundance comes into your life, you have to give the abundance back out in order to keep everything flowing cyclically. And my experience thus far has been just that. The more I give, the more I seem to receive. It's not been my intention in doing it, but I love and I'm really grateful that that's been my experience. So abundance comes across the board in a lot of different ways. So it might be financial for you, it might be emotional, but my experience has been, yes, without a doubt, across the board, it's absolutely possible. And in my case, it's true.
Well, I would actually have to agree with Vikram.
That was exactly 10 words, I think. I hope so.
Can I ask you to say something about
it? Yeah, you want to say something?
I just wanted to be funny and say probably as well, because that is how I feel. I do think when you put the question that constructively, it's hard to say no. It seems sort of obvious. Yeah, of course. But there is a real thing I see in these comment sections where, you know, hipsters no longer like their favorite hipster band when that hipster band gets too popular. It's not okay to be running a nonprofit if you're making a couple hundred thousand dollars. It's questionable if you're the head of Patagonia or whatever and you own multiple homes. So there is this sort of popular notion, which could be correct or not, that poverty is somehow virtuous and making money is somehow you're beginning to sell out. Historically, that's been no problem for Elephant. I've definitely been very broke, so I've been very popular with people on that particular level. But I do think that if we are going to transform business into an engine for good, you have to succeed and keep those ethics. And I think greed is always a factor. How much do we need? Hopefully we can give it all away. He or she who gives away the most toys wins.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, panel. You guys are amazing. Well, let's open it up. We've got about 10 minutes to take any questions that you might have. Anyone have any questions, thoughts, ideas?
Should I go to the microphone? Or? Probably the mic.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if it's on, but I'm in the unfortunate position of having come in just when the Q&A session started, so I missed the entire talk. So if you covered any of this stuff, then... I apologize, and we'll go to the next question. But I'm wondering how much, in terms of getting these messages out, this knowledge out that the world needs, and had we all been able to hear what Sean said and what all of you are saying, then maybe it would change a lot of lives and people would think about things differently. Have you looked at virtual classrooms, so virtual technology to kind of beam this message out rather than, so this talk, you know, we hear it. We are a very small population of the world. A bigger population will listen to podcast, and there's other sort of bigger events as well. But how much have you guys looked into this virtual technology, and how much do you think it's part of the future for changing the world and getting this knowledge out there, getting your messages out there.
And when you say virtual technology, so some examples of what you might think of.
So I would be thinking online interactive video conferencing, so virtual classrooms somewhere where everybody gets together in a huge classroom. Maybe there's 10,000 people from around the world, and they're interacting, asking questions, and you're fielding them over video conferencing.
Uh-huh.
This exists. Yeah, there's quite a few organizations. One, for example, is an organization called Yoga Glow that does downloadable yoga classes, meditation classes, yoga classes, and a variety of teachers from a variety of different systems. And you can download 30-minute programs, 10-minute programs, hour-longs. There's also, I think it's called Maestro something.
You can find Sean on Gaiam TV.
Yeah, Gaiam TV. It also does teleconferences, and you can get thousands and thousands of people, and they break up in groups, and the conversations can be very, very diverse. There is so much now on the internet that you can do related to spirituality and self-help and embodied practices that it's awe-inspiring and may potentially put me out of business. It also excites me about this possibility, and it challenges a teacher like myself to have to learn how do you break the fourth wall of the internet and create the same kind of a passion and intimacy and emotion that you can do in a live environment. So I've really enjoyed the challenge of putting out live classes, and I also love that it means that the audience can be way more diverse. People who wouldn't show up in a class because they're afraid that they're too heavy or infirmed, or perhaps don't have the funds to be able to drop into a $25 class, but they can afford perhaps a free YouTube, well, obviously they can afford a free YouTube video, but they can go online and get the same content and explore it in the safety of their own home. So this technology does exist.
Mm. Yeah, please, thank you.
You guys maybe can help with this. I'm helping a Buddhist organization, except it's a big international organization, bring in their social media together. Interesting is they want to do it, but there is fear of, oh no, we cannot let everybody speak. We cannot let people blog. Is there worries, or have you experienced that maybe when you work with some other nonprofit organization of, no, we can't blog about this. No, this needs to be taboo. Or you can only have maybe people who are, I don't know, have special teachings, or, you know? I mean, do you have, because you talk, Sean, about, you just tell how it feels, and I think, I agree, that's how, what it reaches people. But what about dealing with bigger organizations that are still uncomfortable with social?
Well, if I could say one thing, I was on a social media panel a couple years ago with Whole Foods, which is incredibly successful on Twitter, and they were talking specifically about Twitter, and they said that they had limited success in social media and communicating their message and being good for their brand. And I think this is analogous even to a Sangha, to a Buddhist community. As long as they tried to control the message, and finally they gave up on having this sort of corporate voice saying strawberries are on sale on Friday, $3.69. No one cared. No one retweeted. No one followed. As soon as they empowered one lady, and I forgot her name, but she's here in Austin. I've never met her. But her name's Whitney or something like that. They empowered her and her voice to speak for all of Whole Foods. So if she's in a bad mood, if she hasn't had her coffee, you know, you can imagine that might be kind of questionable for the board of Whole Foods to empower this one woman. And now I think there's a whole team that does it. But once they did that, there was a human being. And I think that's so important in digital communication, is to have genuine, good old-fashioned human heart kind of communication coming through. So I do think it is important to control some things. There's some messages I won't certainly allow on Elephant Journal. I'm happy to have someone write a pro Mitt Romney or Rick Santorum article and a pro Obama or whatever article. That's not the kind of thing I would try and control, because the 2.0 nature of the web would inform either article. That said, if there was an article about how it was great to, you know, perpetrate sex crimes or something, you know, that's not really a conversation I really want to have. So I do think there is, in my Buddhist community, we talk a lot about container, and that without some sort of guiding principles, there can't be a genuine conversation. So I would take out the word control, but I would say there does need to be some sort of voice and guide.
And I'm sorry. I would just like to add that I'm building a social media strategy right now for a pretty traditional group of yogis, pretty very large organization that, and the woman that I'm working with is having very similar challenges. So we're building a strategy because sometimes, you know, the internet and social media, obviously it moves so fast, it's changing so fast, and you know, it, we think that we just need to be on the fly all the time, posting what's happening right now. By merging sometimes like the like sort of an old school business model with this new school business model, it sometimes can sort of quell the worry about, oh, what if, you know, what if this message goes out and I don't have control over it. But we are building sort of a year-long strategy for them and presenting it to them, it's really kind of dispelling some of their fears, and it's actually allowing for a lot more freedom to happen. So they kind of know what our goals are. You know, we have goals that we want to meet every single quarter, and they know what those goals are, and they're comfortable, and they're behind them. And then the kind of the intermittent free, you know, kind of on the fly posting or tweeting, it's worked out really well. They've been a lot more comfortable with it.
That's great.
We have 1 minute left, maybe for one question, a quick answer, comment.
I'll ask something. Maybe I don't know if you can answer it quickly or not.
Sure.
I'm thinking in the.
Speak up, please. Raise your voice.
Is this working?
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. Okay. It is. Okay. I'm just thinking in the context of Mr. Broad's articles in the New York Times lately, and the response from the yoga community. I think it's certainly been valuable. You know, certainly Elephant Journal provides a valuable forum for responding to external stimuli, such as those articles. But I'm wondering how, or if you have any strategies or any ideas about how to move beyond the yoga community. Because I think something in the Elephant Journal is basically, you know, it's certainly valuable to hear those responses, but in a sense, the community that's going to read the yoga, the Elephant Journal is probably already invested in that. I'm wondering how you can, or if you have any ideas for moving beyond the yoga community and using these technologies to do so.
Well, I can tell you briefly that one of our... Are you okay there, Waylon?
I'm cool. I was just so excited to answer that.
I'll do this quickly. What we're doing with Yoga Votes is that we actually went into partnership with Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post, and the blogs that we're going to be writing will be posted on Huffington, and we're hoping to even get our own vertical so that we can begin to bridge that gap between the yoga world and mainstream people who might not understand yogis or may have an understanding of yogis that's just mythological, and give them an opportunity to see that yogis are also very invested in the environment, in healthcare, in education, and see those principles. So we're starting to bleed over. That's one of the ways. So we're definitely looking more towards mainstream media, but also recognizing that media like Elephant Journal, there's a lot of mainstreamers that are also exploring and dabbling. So we want to also enter into the more traditional as a way, but to keep the conversation smart. Because if I read Unicorns and Strawberries, it's the same thing. I turn off. And so I want to make sure that our languaging is really smart no matter where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just jump in, if I may, that our mission is actually to spread the good word. This is like a quote from our mission, to spread the good word beyond the core or choir and to those who didn't know that they gave a care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we are growing organically. We aren't getting investors. We aren't trying to blow up and succeed in the way that Arianna certainly has pioneered for all of us who are online. And I've blogged on Huffington, as has Sean and probably others here. But my complaint with a lot of mainstream media is that it's not necessarily mission driven. So it's a wonderful vehicle. And it has, you know, depends on which kind of media, who you're talking about. But at this point, you know, we're growing 20 or 30% a month. We're at 1.2 million readers. A year ago, we were at 300,000. Those are unique readers, Google Analytics. Our goal is to crush Huffington Post, New York Times, Washington Post, just lay waste to the media landscape and dominate. It's a joke, yeah. No, but our goal is to be mainstream. There is valuable to communicate with the core or choir, but that's certainly not enough if we're trying to affect any kind of meaningful change.
I think another thing is to just for people to realize that what people who are interested in yoga are interested in is the same thing that everyone else is interested in. It's just sometimes the word yoga gets you in a different category, And I think this gentleman was commenting on articles in the New York Times about scandals, and there was something about like the yoga being
wreck your body.
About yoga wrecking your body, and also there was a mention that yoga started off as a sex cult, and true, that debate will go on between yogis online, and someone will say, well, that's not true, but the rest of the world is seeing that one article in the New York Times, and I think that's just about how the internet is a great tool for new voices to be out there. And I think one thing for people in the yoga world is to realize that it's not just, it's not just a scene, and this conversation isn't just sort of this internal gossip and scandal thing, but everybody out there is looking for the same thing. And sometimes you might have to, sort of sneak it in to the mainstream by not putting labels on it and not necessarily saying, scaring people off with Sanskrit and other things like that. And so people don't turn off. So I think it's just a way of sort of playing the game and getting into the mainstream without people really knowing it. I know when I made my film, I was very conscious about not saying this is a yoga film in any way. This is about, it was something about human nature in general. And I think that's just a way of getting into the mainstream, but maybe tricking people a little bit. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And also being here. Applying to be on a panel at South by Southwest and talking about yoga and how but also I think we say the word yoga, but I think all of us up here, Buddhism, all of us up here really want to encourage and empower everyone and every single one of you to find your lens, find what calls to you, find what speaks to you, and speak from that authentic place. I choose this, and I'm really happy with my choice, and it makes me happy, and it gives me joy, and I can show up authentically online, and Sean, off the mat into the world, and we say, off the mat and onto my computer, because I sit on my computer for 12 hours a day, and so if I can't authentically engage with people while I'm there, then why am I there? What is it worth? And so being able to be here at South by Southwest and being able to speak about what's important to us to maybe not a traditional yoga audience, all of you out there, in the back, you, but, it, I think, is steps in the right direction, and we'll be back.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, dream big. If you see something, say something, because if someone touches your community in a way and it's a bad touch and it feels like that's not true, what they're saying is really not representative of what this word means, you can speak out. You can do it in a mindful way, and you can stand up for yourself and stand up for your beliefs and dream real big. And that's how this panel came together. We had an idea and we invited people, and look at this incredible situation that we've got right in front of us. So go for it and use social media, till the cows come home, basically. So we're going to put our contact information up there, as 50% of our programming is dedicated to service, and I bet a lot of you out there are doing some service work. So we have a newsletter sign-up sheet. You are welcome to share your information with us, and we will keep you posted about what's going on the show and elsewhere. These are our partners. These are our line friends, and we will be keeping closely in touch with them and keeping you posted about what they're doing. And online radio is free, so right on for more free. And I think we're going to ask Waylon to bow us out as we come to a close of our panel.
So yeah, in the Buddhist tradition, we begin and end the day by dedicating any merit of what we've accomplished to others. So if you got anything out of this, hopefully now's time to give it away. Thank you. Thanks very much.